So in Guru Jan Prabhu's outline of chapter 2, then he breaks it down into five parts. First part is the continuation of Arjuna's doubts. Then the second part, once Krishna starts speaking, then is on jnana, or having knowledge. Means Krishna's first instructions, jnana, the soul can never die, the body can never be saved. Then the third part is karmakanda. Then as Krishna next explains, working in karmakanda consciousness, material gains, heaven or kingdom, from fighting and material losses, infamy and sin, from not fighting. Then buddhi yoga, nishkam karma. Krishna explains buddhi yoga, nishkam karma, wherein one works karma with knowledge, jnana, and is thus detached from the fruit of his work. And then samadhi. By working in buddhi yoga, one attains material detachment and the equipoised platform of liberation called samadhi. So he first shows what is knowledge, understand the difference between matter and spirit, then what are material activities, what are the benefits and losses you get. Then he shows that working with the proper knowledge of the soul, one should give up the fruits of the activities. Right? Karmakanda means you work for a result. Right? You follow prescribed duties for a result. That's karmakanda. If you follow prescribed duties not for a result, but to please Krishna, then that is buddhi yoga. It means you're using your intelligence. You're doing because of intelligence. Karma means you're doing generally because it's some desire. There's that emotional desire that the feelings towards the family, the traditions of the family, like Arjuna is pointing out. And, you know, have to be good and do all these different things and, you know, so many things that one is worried about. And where if you do that, it's pious, then you'll be benefited in next life and in this life. And if you don't, it's adharma and all this kind of thing. So it's all very emotional like this. This is the platform of manamoya. So that it's mainly the mind. You know, if you use the intelligence, but it's still within the realm of the mind. So buddhi yoga means the intelligence is what is functioning. And the mind is also engaged. It means the intelligence engages the mind rather than the mind engages the intelligence. Is this understood? Mind means accepting and rejecting. So now the mind uses the intelligence to figure out what is the best things to accept and what are the best things to reject for one's own pleasure. The buddhi yoga means, or intelligence, where you're using the intelligence, means that the intelligence is working, this is what should be done. And whether the mind likes it or not, we do it. Right? Like sadhana. Sunday, we're supposed to chant now. We would rather just go out in the courtyard, sit and talk. But we know, this is nonsense. So the mind, the intelligence controls the mind. Then things go very nicely. Then with time, the mind becomes readjusted and, you know, gets used to it. It's like someone is telling me where they're taking care of the cows. It's a very interesting phenomenon. Is that during the winter and summer months, then the cows are all eating, you know, fresh grass and things like that. So then when rainy season comes and there's no fresh grass available, then they have to eat straw. So you give them the straw, they won't eat it. So then, since the other's not available, either let it sit there for a couple of days, or you just don't even bother feeding them. You just leave their trays empty. And then after, you know, some time when they really get hungry, then you bring them the straw, they happily eat it. Then, the whole rainy season goes by, they've been eating straw every day. Then when the green grass comes, they won't eat that. Because now they're used to straw. They like straw. They don't want to eat this green grass. So then you have to do the same thing again. You have to just not feed them until they get real hungry. And then you feed them the green grass, then they eat that. Or in the taming of an elephant also. Once they get the elephant to fall into the hole, the first thing they do is just don't feed him for 3 days. You know, so elephants, they're used to eating few hundred kilos of edibles every day, so for them not to eat for 3 days is a big austerity. So then after 3 days, then the mahouts start going with food, you know, and they take their little thing and, you know, the what is it? Ankusha? Huh? The goad, yeah. And then they, you know, they let them know who's boss. And in this way, by the process of like this, they adjust. And then they come to the point where they accept the mahout, takes care of them, feeds them, and then they become attached to the mahout. Like that. So the same way is this, the intelligence controls the mind. His mind is wild. And then if you just put it in line for so long, after a while it gets used to it, and it likes it like that. It likes the regulation. And I've seen that's just the mind is crazy. You know, you start from that premise, then you find that dealing with the mind is not so difficult. You start with the premise that the mind is nuts, the untrained mind is nuts. Then dealing with the mind becomes easy, because that means if it's nuts, means whatever it dreams up, I don't have to listen to. Right? If I take the mind seriously, when the mind comes out with all kinds of different ideas and that, then I become very disturbed. I have to follow it. The thinking goes into feeling and into willing, and I have to work. But if it's just a matter of the mind thinks up all kinds of things, what do I care? You know, like that. You know, some madman sitting in the corner and he's espousing his philosophy and saying this and that and standing on the chair and, you know, who cares? You know, it's a mad guy. So then when it comes up with different things, you just ignore it, unless it was, you know, a decent idea. Like the mind just decides, I want to go to the temple. Yeah, then that's great. If you're in the temple and the mind says, you know, I want to go outside and talk to Jalpa, then you just ignore it, you know, like that. And the thing is it is another living entity. It is another, not a living entity, it's another entity, you know, just like this table is different from me. So in the same way, as the mind is different from us. It's an element, just like the body, earth, water, fire, air, ether. It's an element. Just its nature is it accepts and rejects. So it does like that. Intelligence is also another element, separate from us. But because we've been living with this particular mind and intelligence, you know, since time immemorial, due to our false ego, then we identify that this is us, right? Means we have enough trouble just identifying the body with ourselves, where we're so attached to it, and we only got it this life. So we've only been dealing with it for however old. But the mind and intelligence, we've been carrying with this body to body to body since time immemorial. So we get real used to it. You know, it's because it's been with us the most. But The point is that we're separate from it. We're different from it. This is very important. It's not us. So the mind can dream of all kinds of demoniac, this, that. You just let it go by. Who cares? That's the mind. If we take the mind seriously, when it's un-Krishna conscious, we're in big trouble. And this happens many times. Devotee will be going along, very nicely doing the service, fired up, all these things. And then one day the mind goes, hey, wait a minute, I'm working so hard for everybody else, working for the temple, doing this and that, and putting in all my time and energy, and bringing so much money and doing so much work. But what about me? What do I got out of it? And then the devotee thinks, yeah, hey, this is a serious point. And then they, you know, adjust their whole like paradigm of how they think and go outside and try to set up for themselves, and you know, in their mid-40s tries to put together a whole scene for themselves and like this, and it becomes very difficult. And it's just the mind came up with that. You could just think, well, that's stupid, and just the intelligence can tell the mind what's there. But because we identify with it so strong, because it came up with it, then we relate to it. So the whole process of buddhi yoga, why devotional service is this stage, or the stage of sadhana, where you're doing your activities for Krishna, is called buddhi yoga, because the intelligence has to control the mind. Otherwise the mind won't follow prescribed duties. Right? The karmakanda, the mind follows prescribed duties because the mind knows, I do this, I get this back. So this is a pious person. I follow this austere path, or I follow this regulation, because I know that in the future, you know, we'll become wealthy, we'll go to the heavenly planets, we might even become a big demigod, something will happen. So the mind likes that, because the mind is connected to the senses, and anything to do with the senses, position, honor, distinction, profit, the mind is totally into. So then you present this. That's why the Vedas, the Karmakanda section is written in that way. It's just talking results. Go to the heavenly planets, people are deathless, you know, everything's wonderful, beautiful, you know, nice, you know, there's no pollution. You know, there's no, you know, it's like everybody, there's a greenie. You know, I mean, it's just everything's wonderful up there. Like that. And then you just think, this is great, I want to go there. So, but to do that, then you got to follow this, and then you get this benefit for that, and you do that, and you get this benefit for that, and all these different things. Then they think, yes, I'll do all that. You know? But then here, we're being asked to follow the same duties, but without that result, that attachment. So, how are you going to be motivated? Right? I'm motivated to follow Karmakanda or Jnanakanda because I have a desire I want. My mind wants something. Something material I can relate to. Right? Accepting or rejecting? Karmakanda is accepting, Jnanakanda is rejecting. You know, but it's all in the mental platform. That's why it's all manamoy. Whether one is going for liberation, you're still using the mind. This is mental speculation. Or you're following the Karmakanda, it's still the mind. So it's all manamoy. Like that. So now one is having to follow both these paths together. Right? Do your duty like a Karmakanda would, but without attachment like the Jnanakanda. But for Krishna, the devotee. So that takes intelligence. So the intelligence has to control rather than the mind. Therefore we say buddhi yoga. So the process of sadhana bhakti, in which we engage ourselves in all varieties of activities for Krishna's pleasure, it's called buddhi yoga because it's not the mind. And we use our intelligence to see what is the nature, what things we can do. Or use our intelligence to put ourselves into others. They can tell us what to do, what our nature is. And then it works very nicely. Okay. Does that make some sense? How those... Right. So it's very natural. Krishna explained karma, I mean jnana, to separate the two. Between matter and spirit. Then, he's mentioned duties. Then he puts them together. Like that. So in this way, then chapter 2 becomes the summary of the whole Gita. And then samadhi is just fully absorbed in devotional activities. So the whole Gita is going through that. You know, chapters 3 and 5 are dealing with that aspect of the karma yoga, how to engage the activities. Chapter 4 is the knowledge. Chapter 5 then gets into nishkam karma and the knowledge going with that, liberation. And then it just keeps going. Then the middle section of the Gita is all the devotional. Main emphasis on devotional service, Krishna, how he enters, how he's pervading everything, how we can see Krishna everywhere. And then the end of the Gita is predominantly on the jnana section. Jnana, how to understand, differentiate between matter and spirit. So we see that all these three are mentioned in this chapter. So it becomes the summary for the whole Gita. Chapter 2. Sanjaya said, seeing Arjuna full of compassion, his mind depressed, his eyes full of tears, Madhusudan, Krishna, spoke the following words. Then here, Madhusudan is being pointed out that Dhritarashtra is very happy now to hear that Arjuna is going to sit down and not fight. This is exactly what he's been waiting for. Because he asked in the beginning, what will my sons and sons of Pandu do? And he's worried that there may be some problem. So then here Krishna is called Madhusudan because he'll kill Madhu, the Madhu demon. These were demons that came before the creation. They were very unique demons because they came from the body of Vishnu. They come from the back part, because the back part of Vishnu is where irreligion resides, like that. So Krishna is complete. Everything's there. So from there came Madhu and Kaitava. And they were said special demons. So Brahma was born. And Brahma had learned the Vedas. But he hasn't done his creation. It means Krishna has done his part of the creation, manifest all the material elements and the modes of nature, time and all these things. But the planetary systems, all that the Brahma will create, and the living entity hasn't been done yet. So it's just about time to start that. Brahma is now created, but then Madhu and Kaitava come. And then they go into his mind. Right? These are, you know, very unique burglars, is that they can enter into the mind and steal whatever they like. You know? So they went in there, and being demons, so they stole the Vedas. Right out of his mind. So then this became a difficulty for Brahma, because he just had heard everything from Krishna, and now he's lost it all. So he asked Krishna that you explain this again to him. And then Krishna then, I think it's Hayagriva maybe, kills the Madhu demon like this. So he's known as Madhusudan because he's killing that. So doubts are coming on this mental platform. The mind brings up all the doubts like that. So Krishna being called Madhusudan means he's going to destroy these doubts of Arjuna. So Sanjay doesn't want Dhritarashtra to get too enthusiastic, you know, otherwise it's not good for him. He's an old man. The Supreme Personality of Godhead said, "My dear Arjuna, how have these impurities come upon you? They are not at all befitting a man who knows the value of life. They lead not to higher planets, but to infamy." So he says here, "Anarya Jushtam," it's not befitting an Aryan. This we mentioned yesterday. Aryan means human life. Human life means duties. So now Arjuna is saying, I'm going to give up my duties because I'm not going to get any benefit from it. If I perform my prescribed duties as a Kshatriya, I'm not going to get any material bliss from it. So I don't want to do that. So this is Anarya. This is not how an Aryan works. Aryan works, a king works, even if he loses. You have your duty, you do that. King gives his word, he does it. Even if he loses everything. Many stories like this in the history. You know, the word is given. Even if it's bad for them, they will follow it. This is one way also to tell the difference between a Vaishya and a Kshatriya. Is Vaishya gives you his word, but if he figures out later by, you know, calculating, hey, I'm going to lose here, or someone else comes along and offers a better deal, then you won't get the deal. He'll break his promise. But a Kshatriya, even if it means he loses, he gave his word, you'll get it. The loss is his, not yours, because he gave the words. For them, the word is more important than the profit. Like this. This is a, like that. So, here, as a Kshatriya, it's very unbefitting that they've been fighting his come, and he's not taking it. So this is Anarya. O son of Prita, do not yield to this degrading impotence. It does not become you. Give up such petty weakness of heart and arise, O chastiser of the enemy. Yeah. So calling a Kshatriya, yeah. Prabhupada says here, if the son of a Kshatriya declines to fight, he's a Kshatriya in name only. It means he's a Kshatra Bandhu, a friend of the Brahmins. He lives in the palace. And here he points out that his arguments were kshudram, means very low class and not very solid, not very important. Arjuna said, O killer of enemies, O killer of Madhu, how can I counter attack with arrows in battle men like Bhishma and Drona who are worthy of my worship? So Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says that Arjuna addressed Krishna as Madhusudana and Arishudana, means that he is the killer of his enemies, you know, not his guru and his grandfather. So it's like, you're saying I should kill, but you I don't see any example of you killing your, you know, grandfather and teacher. You're killing enemies, you know, but you're telling me that I'm going to have to kill my grandfather and my teacher. than it would be better to live in this world by begging than to live at the cost of the lives of great souls who are my teachers. Even though desiring worldly gain, they are superiors. If they are killed, even everything we enjoy will be tainted with blood. You know. So here the point comes is that Kshatriyas don't beg, they rule. So just saying it's better to even go to such an extent than to kill the teacher. That, and Prabhupada points out in the purport that even you don't give a verbal argument to a superior. Like that. So you accept what they're saying. Or you can present points, doubts, but it has to be done properly, like we see throughout the Gita. Whole thing is full of Krishna Arjuna's doubts, but he's presenting them very pleasantly. It's not an argument. He makes a point, and then Krishna speaks. He makes another point. Krishna speaks. This. Nor do we know which is better, conquering them or being conquered by them. If we killed the sons of Dhritarashtra, we should not care to live. Yet they are standing before us on the battlefield. Okay. Okay, so Prabhupada writes in the purport that Arjuna has the qualities necessary to receive knowledge. His mind and senses are controlled. He is detached, faithful, and tolerant. Perplexed, yet eager for enlightenment. It means if you have qualities, you can accept knowledge. If there's no qualities, no knowledge. Therefore, the Vedic culture, the whole emphasis was on training people in qualities. Especially from a young age, because then you can learn. No qualities, no knowledge. I mean, you can learn. You can become, in modern terms, you know, literate, and literacy and numeracy. But that's not real knowledge, because you don't know how to behave, how to interface with people, how to exchange like that. So here, because he has these things, he's feeling with these other members of the family, he's compassionate, he's gentle, all these different considerations. So he's qualified to learn. Now I am confused about my duty and have lost all composure because of miserly weakness. In this condition, I am asking you to tell me for certain what is best for me. Now I am your disciple and a soul surrendered unto you. Please instruct me. Yeah, so Arjuna has based his reasons for fighting on compassion, logic, and shastra. Yeah? But he has not put it, he hasn't come to siddhanta, conclusion. So now he's okay. Yeah, so then here Prabhupada then points out that by nature's own way, the complete system of material activities is a source of perplexity for everyone. In every step, there is perplexity. And therefore, it behooves one to approach a bona fide spiritual master who can give one proper guidance for executing the purpose of life. All Vedic literatures advise us to approach a bona fide spiritual master to get free from the perplexities of life, which happens without our desire. They are like a forest fire that somehow blazes without being set by anyone. Similarly, the world situation is such that the perplexities of life automatically appear without our wanting such confusion. Okay, so the whole point is one must approach a spiritual master. Here he's quoting Shastra, he's being very logical, and he's basing it on good qualities, compassion. It means there's some training. But without a guide, without spiritual master, these things aren't very relevant. Okay, so Baladeva Vidyabhushan points out, when he says he's perplexed, then Krishna gives a reply as follows. You know Shastra, why not use your own logic and reasoning? And then Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says that Krishna replies, I am your friend, I am not in the mood of being your guru. So how can I accept you as my disciple? Because you have a respectful attitude towards Vyasadeva and others, why not go to them? So Krishna is testing him. His initial response is he's just testing, just brushing him off. And then, but Arjuna again says the point. I can find no means to drive away this grief which is drying up my senses. I will not be able to dispel it, even if I win a prosperous, unrivaled kingdom on earth with sovereignty like the demigods in heaven. Sanjaya said, having spoken thus, Arjuna, chastiser of the enemies, told Krishna, Govinda, I shall not fight. He fell silent. So here, Baladev Vibhushan comments that Arjuna, by addressing Krishna as Hrishikesh, the master of the senses, indicates, because you are the master of my senses, you are going to draw my intelligence into involving me with fighting. And because you are the knower of the Vedas, you are going to make me understand that this fighting is my personal dharma. And then Prabhupada explains the significance of the word parantapa. Dhritarashtra must have been very glad to understand that Arjuna was not going to fight, and was instead leaving the battlefield for begging perfection. But Sanjaya disappointed him again in relating that Arjuna was competent to kill his enemies, parantapa. So here Sanjaya calls him parantapa, because otherwise he sat down now, so Dhritarashtra thing now he's become useless. But he calls him parantapa. No, he's very qualified to kill his enemy. So then Krishna, O descendant of Bharata, at that time Krishna, smiling in the midst of both the armies, spoke the following words to the grief-stricken Arjuna. So here Prabhupada explains that Krishna is smiling because his friend has become a disciple. So that's very interesting, you know. Here the rasas, Arjuna is always kind of chiding Krishna because he's in a superior position in the social structure. And now Arjuna has surrendered to Krishna as his disciple. So it's kind of amusing to him, you know, the whole thing. And this then gives way to parental affection, which is similar to the relationship between guru and disciple. Then Krishna became grave because he was teaching. And Prabhupada says here, it appears that the talk between the master and the disciple was openly exchanged in the presence of both armies so that all were benefited. So it's mentioned in the beginning that Krishna spoke this Gita in the presence so that everybody could be benefited. The Supreme Personality of God had said, so now we start the jnana. Jnana is from... Jnana is 11 to 30. The Supreme Personality of God had said, so while speaking learned words, you are mourning for what is not worthy of grief. Those who are wise lament neither for the living nor the dead. Never was there a time when I did not exist, nor you, nor all these kings, nor in the future shall any of us cease to be. So Krishna's pointing out, in the past I was Krishna, I am Krishna now, in the future I'll be Krishna. You were there in the past, you're here now, in the future you'll be here. Same with the kings. So this Prabhupada points out that this is a very important verse for defeating the Mayavadis. As the embodied soul continually passes in this body from boyhood to youth to old age, the soul similarly passes into another body at death. A sober person is not bewildered by such a change. Yeah. Okay, so then Krishna's pointing out here is that you're worrying that you're going to kill Bhishma and Drona, but they're going to get old anyway. They're already old, and they're going to die, and they're going to get a new body, and no one's lamenting that. And then the example here is given to Maharaj Yayati. When he traded his old body for a youthful body, no one complained, hey, where's the old wrinkly body you used to have? No one got upset. So his point is, you know, you're getting so upset about that they're going to get new young bodies, but what's the problem with that? It says both Vishwanath and Baladev then say that Arjuna agrees with Krishna that Bhishma and Drona would be better off in young bodies. But Arjuna explains his reluctance to fight is due to his current relationship with him. Because they get young bodies, they'll be benefited. But I lose the relationship with them. You know? So like that. So here is a comment by Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakura. One may say, by connection with the self, even one's body becomes an object of affection. By connection with one's body, one's children, siblings, and so on also become dear. So when they are destroyed, one naturally experiences unhappiness. This objection is answered by the verse beginning, Dehina, the jiva, who is the possessor of the body, reaches the stage of childhood. When that body is then destroyed, he reaches youth. And when the youth is destroyed, he reaches old age. In the same way, one attains another body. So just as one doesn't lament when the changes of childhood and youth have been destroyed, even though they are objects of his affection, similarly, one should not lament when the body is destroyed, even though it is an object of affection because of its connection with the self. So one may counterclaim that there are indeed unhappiness when one's youth is destroyed and one reaches old age. But in response, we can say that one rejoices when his childhood is destroyed and he reaches youth. Thus, we should rejoice that Bhishma, Drona, and others are going to receive new bodies after their old ones are destroyed. Or else we may say that just as one person in the same body achieves all the stages beginning with childhood, similarly the same one jiva who possesses bodies attains the whole series of bodies. And then Baladeva Vidyabhushan comments, one may say, although the souls who are now conditioned by the bodies of Bhishma and so on are eternal, it is natural that there is sorrow upon the destruction of their bodies, which were the facilities for their enjoyment. The answer is as follows. With the destruction of the decrepit bodies of Bhishma and so on, they are going to receive new bodies. That should be a cause of rejoicing, just as was the Ayati's regaining his youth. Then Krishna replies in text 14, O son of Kunti, the non-permanent appearance of happiness and distress and their disappearance in due course are like the appearance and disappearance of winter and summer seasons. They arise from sense perception, O Skaina Bharata, and one must learn to tolerate them without being disturbed. So in other words, we're tolerating day to day so many difficulties that don't go the way we want. So he's saying we should continue to tolerate like this. 15. O best among men, Arjuna, the person who is not disturbed by happiness and distress and is steady in both is certainly eligible for liberation. Okay, so now he's... So this is the first time now he's mentioned a spiritual goal. You know, before he was just saying, why you're lamenting for these bodies, you're going to change anyway. And be tolerant, because that's part of just Vedic culture. So now he's bringing in this spiritual point. 16. Those who are seers of the truth have concluded that of the non-existent, the material body, there is no endurance, and of the eternal, the soul, there is no change. This they have concluded by studying the nature of both. So he's pointing out, Krishna's rebuking Arjuna here, because he says, you're speaking on Shastra and so learned, but you've missed this point. Because the real seers of the truth, they have said that the material body and material world is temporary, it's non-existent, asat, and the soul and spiritual activities are eternal. So you missed this point. 17. That which pervades the entire body you should know to be indestructible. No one is able to destroy that imperishable soul. The material body of the indestructible, immeasurable, and eternal living entity is sure to come to an end. Therefore fight, O descendant of Bharata. So he's pointing out here is the soul anyway is going to live, and the body is going to come to an end, because the body doesn't last anyway. So you're lamenting for this body, but it's going to come anyway to an end. You know? So, therefore, what's your problem? So Prabhupada here writes, so from both viewpoints, there's no cause of lamentation, because the living entity, as he is, cannot be killed, nor can the material body be saved for any length of time or permanently protected. So either way, it's not a problem. They're going to die anyway, can't protect them. And the soul is eternal. So from either side, there's not a problem. 19. Neither he who thinks the living entity the slayer, neither he who thinks the living entity the slayer, nor he who thinks it slain is in knowledge. For the self slays not, nor is slain. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur comments, the self is neither the subject of the act of killing, nor its object. He who thinks that the soul is the killer, that Arjuna is killing Bhishma and others, and he who thinks that the soul is killed, that Bhishma and others have been killed by Arjuna, are both ignorant. No one can kill or be killed. Krishna elaborates on this point in the next verse, 20. For the soul there is neither birth nor death at any time. He has not come into being, does not come into being, and will not come into being. He is unborn, eternal, ever-existing, and primeval. He is not slain when the body is slain. So the soul never is born or dies. It's just the body. So the body is doing the slaying, the body is doing the dying, the soul is not. So the soul is eternal, so there's no reason to lament. 21. O Partha, how can a person who knows that the soul is indestructible, eternal, unborn, and immeasurable, kill anyone or cause anyone to kill? Okay. Then Prabhupada writes here, although the justice of the peace awards, although the justice of the peace awards capital punishment to a person condemned for murder, the justice of the peace cannot be blamed, because he orders violence to another person according to the codes of justice. Similarly, when Krishna orders fighting, it must be concluded that violence is for supreme justice, and thus Arjuna should follow the instruction, knowing well that such violence committed in the act of fighting for Krishna is not violence at all, because at any rate the man, or rather the soul, cannot be killed. So for the administration of justice, so-called violence is permitted. Also, it's like in a war, there's fighting. Killing is going on, but no one is blamed for it. Like that. So in the same way, if it's for a particular higher cause of justice, then it is not violence. And Baladeva Vibhushan, he says, Arjuna may think, granting that the soul does not die, still the bodies of the men called Bhishma and others are going to be destroyed in the battle. That is wrong, because it will improperly deprive them of the happiness they derive from their bodies. And Krishna explains Arjuna's fault of that logic in the next verse. As a person puts on new garments, giving up old ones, the soul similarly accepts new material bodies, giving up the old and useless ones. So they're going to change anyway. So it's like, even if Arjuna doesn't kill him, he'll die anyway. 23. The soul can never be cut to pieces by any weapon, nor burned by fire, nor moistened by water, nor withered by the wind. 24. This individual soul is unbreakable and insoluble. Here, Bhujan points out interesting points, is that all these things cannot be cut to pieces by any weapon, because he has arrows and swords, nor burned by fire, moistened by water, withered by wind. These are all the different weapons that the astras. You have the wind weapon, the fire weapon, the water weapon. Like someone sends a fire weapon, you send a water weapon. You know, someone sends a water weapon, you send a mountain weapon. Oh no, I think it's the other way around. Like this. So you have different weapons for the things. So these are the weapons they use. Otherwise you would think, why would he mention these things? Because the soul is not going to be bothered by any of these weapons of Arjuna. 24. This individual soul is unbreakable and insoluble, and can be neither burned nor dried. He is everlasting, present everywhere, unchangeable, immovable, and eternally the same. It is said that the soul is invisible, inconceivable, and immutable. Knowing this, you should not grieve for the body. Okay, so... So now he points out that in the next verse, now he's going to start a new topic. Up to now, he's just been talking about the soul. You know, you're a fool for thinking that now they're going to be killed and they're not around and so much loss, but they're going to get a new body anyway. You can't kill them. Anyway, you're not killing them. You know, like that. Your body is killing their body. You as the soul are not killing them as the soul. And in any way, they're going to die. So up to this point, then he says, because he uses the word artha-cha, that means he's going to start a new... So this last thing, soul is invisible, inconceivable, immutable. Knowing this, you should not grieve for the body. So all this is like the summation of this little part here, just on the soul. And then Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur explains Krishna's thinking. I have thus far explained things to you from the viewpoint of Shastra. Now I'll explain them from the worldly point of view. So now he goes into the other. 26. If, however, you think that the soul are the symptoms of life, is always born and dies forever, you should still have no reason to lament, O mighty armed. So even on the bodily thing, other philosophers, the atheists and the Buddhists, then, let's see, Okay. The other point is if you feel no soul exists, like the Buddhists say there's no soul, and, you know, others may say there's no soul that's separate from the body, it's just chemicals. Then fine. Chemicals are just going through the chemical reaction. What do we care? You know? If, you know, something comes together and you, you know, drop an Alka-Seltzer into a glass of water and it bubbles for some time and then stops, no one laments. It's just chemicals are doing their thing. So even if you think there's no soul and it's just chemicals reacting with chemicals, then what's your problem? Okay, 27. One who has taken his birth is sure to die, and after death, one is sure to take birth again. Therefore, in the unavoidable discharge of your duty, you should not lament. All created beings are unmanifest in their beginning, manifest in their interim state, and unmanifest again when annihilated. So what need is there for lamentation? Then this next verse, some look on the soul as amazing, some describe him as amazing, and some hear of him as amazing, while others, even after hearing about him, cannot understand him at all. So here he's described the soul before. Then he's described, even if you don't believe in the soul, still his argument falls. Now he goes back to the soul is that he's amazing. Ascharyavat means amazing. Pashyati means sees. Okay, some look at the soul as amazing. Second lies, some speak about the soul as amazing. The third lies, some hear about him as, and think of him as amazing. So Prabhupada mentions, some look on the soul as amazing, ascharyavat. Amazing is taken to modify soul, which is the object of the sentence. Baladeva Vidyabhushan has given two more interpretations, where the word ascharyavat additionally modifies the sentence's subject and verb. Thus, each line of the verse can be explained in three ways. As the word for amazing changes from modifying the object, the soul, to modifying the subject and verb. Ascharyavat can modify people, the subject of the sentence. Some people who are amazed look upon the soul. If Ascharyavat modifies the verb look, the sentence reads, some look amazingly at the soul. Depending upon how one translates this amazing verse, the people who see the soul are amazed. The soul is amazing, or the power to see the soul is amazing. The second line, some people describe the soul as amazing, can also be translated in three ways with Bhadadi describes, replacing sees. The third line can be translated in three ways by using the word hears. Yeah, in other words, some people who are amazing means the person themselves, amazing people, they look upon the soul. Means ordinary people are not doing it. Or they amazing people are able to describe the soul, or they're able to see the soul. And some people amazingly look at the soul. Some people means it's amazing. Why is he talking about the soul? You know, everybody else is talking about eating, sleeping, mating, and defending, and this person amazingly is talking, describing, and seeing the soul. And then the last is hear, that's it. Some amazing people hear about the soul, or it's like amazing, he even wants to hear about such topics. You know, we have so many more important things to listen to, you know, what Bill Clinton is doing. And why would someone want to listen to about the soul? Text 30. O descendant of Bharata, he who dwells in the body can never be slain. Therefore you need not grieve for any living being. So now here, Krishna has concluded this part. This is now ends the part which is described as giving the Gyan section. Okay, it says here in the next, the following section, Krishna directly attacks Arjuna's desire based on ignorance to neglect his duty out of a sense of compassion for his family members. In the next group of verses, 31 through 38, Krishna continues his attempt to convince Arjuna to fight. The motives he stresses here, however, are not based on knowledge, but on fruitive activity and religious duty. In this way, Krishna attacks another of Krishna's reasons, that is, he will not be able to enjoy himself after he engages in the battle. Therefore, in text 31 through 33, Krishna presents Arjuna with the argument that dutiful fighting, not fleeing the battlefield, will lead to enjoyment. Okay, so now after concluding this, now Krishna is going to, because Arjuna presented everything from the platform of Karmakanda. One of the things was is that he was saying, you know, the Shastra. Now here he's, Krishna said, you know, you don't understand the difference. You're saying we're going to kill our superiors. How can I kill superiors? So now he's just removed that. You're not going to kill them anyway. They're going to die on their own. You're not, it's just the what do you call it? The bodies are interacting. The chemicals of the material world. So what's your problem? And then now he's going to deal with his point is that I have this big fight, I'll kill everybody, we'll have the kingdom, and how will I enjoy myself? There'll be no one around to enjoy it with. So even if I do my duty, I'm not going to enjoy it. So this is this part now, Krishna is going to, he's going to attack that doubt of Arjuna. 31. Considering your specific duty as a kshatriya, you should know that there is no better engagement for you than fighting on religious principles. So there is no need for hesitation. It says here, for a kshatriya, fighting is equivalent to a Brahmin's performance of fire sacrifices. By performing their duties, neither the kshatriya nor the Brahmin incurs sinful reactions. Therefore, Krishna argues that Arjuna will not suffer sinful reactions in fighting the battle of Kurukshetra. If it is a religious battle and things are done properly, there is no sin. It's his duty. That's what one must do. Of course, as part of it afterwards, then they do a sacrifice to, you know, clear themselves of, like, if there's been any improper dealings or anything like that. Just like the Brahmin, after performing the puja or sacrifice, then does the chidradharana, which is, you know, if there's been any problems, mantrahinam, kriyahinam, viddihinam, any of the mantras chanted, if we made mistakes, any of the rules we followed made mistakes, or any of the little ritual that we followed as mistakes, we please forgive us. So the kshatriya also, they'll be in a chidradharana afterwards, they'll do a sacrifice. Yudhishthira did the big sacrifice afterwards for that reason. 32. O Partha, happy are the kshatriyas to whom such fighting opportunities come unsought, opening for them the doors of the heavenly planets. So now he's fearing for the relatives that they'll go to the heavenly planets anyway. So if he defeats them, but if he doesn't fight, then neither they go to the heavenly planets, neither does he have any position here in the material world, because if he doesn't fight, he'll be rejected as a kshatriya. No one will want to deal with him. So he loses everything. By not fighting, he ends up in the forest, miserable. 33. If, however, you do not perform your religious duty of fighting, then you certainly incur sins for neglecting your duties, and thus lose your reputation as a fighter. So now, Arjuna has specifically said, by fighting and killing, we're going to incur sin. He repeated that many, many times in the first chapter. So now, Krishna is using the opposite on him. If you don't fight, you're not doing your duty as a kshatriya, you will get sinful reaction for that. In other words, you follow God's rules, that is pious. You neglect them, that's sin. On the mundane platform, you follow the Shastric rules, it is pious. You don't follow them, it's sin. It's that simple. Right? And the devotional is, you do something to please Krishna, for Krishna, under direction, that is pious. And you do something, even as following the Shastras, but not for Krishna, that is considered sinful. The difference here, the one is, sin will send you to hell, the pious will send you to the heavenly planets. In the devotional explanation, pious means you'll go back to Godhead, and sinful means you'll remain in the material world. So now here in text 33 through 37, Krishna describes additional losses Arjuna will suffer if he neglects his duty. Arjuna thinks it would be more noble to leave the battlefield, but Krishna argues otherwise. 34. People will always speak of your infamy, and for a respectable person, dishonor is worse than death. Okay. We may question, here Bhurijan points out, oh, here. Okay. Question why a devotee like Arjuna should be concerned about honor and dishonor. We should understand that in this section of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna is not speaking to Arjuna on the transcendental platform of devotional service. Rather, he is addressing Arjuna's brave Kshatriya spirit. The pain of a disgraced life will be more painful than the death for a warrior like Arjuna. Srila Prabhupada paraphrases Krishna's admonishments in his purport. Both as friend and philosopher to Arjuna, Lord Krishna now gives his final judgment regarding Arjuna's refusal to fight. The Lord says, Arjuna, if you leave this battlefield because before the battle even begins, people will call you a coward. And if you think that people may call you bad names, but that you will save your life by fleeing the battlefield, then my advice is that you'd better die in the battle. For a respectable man like you, ill fame is worse than death. So you should not flee for fear of your life. Better to die in the battle. That will save you from the ill fame of misusing my friendship and from losing your prestige in society. I mean, he's friends with the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and now he becomes a coward. Krishna's friends with the best. I mean, of all the Kshatriyas, then Arjuna is the best. You know, in fighting prowess and, you know, so many wonderful ways. So Krishna is his friend, intimate friend. Yudhishthira, he touches his feet. Bhima, he touches his feet. Arjuna, his friends, Nakula and Sahadev, they touch Krishna's feet because they're older. So in the dealings, then like this. So he's not friends with the others. Arjuna is the only one he's taken like this, his friendship. So he'll say, you misuse my friendship. You just go away and this and that. Then people will say, ah, your friend Arjuna was like this. And what kind of friends you keep? And then, you know, it will be a misuse. 35. The great generals who have highly esteemed your name and fame will think you have left the battlefield out of fear only, and thus they will consider you insignificant. Prabhupada elaborates in his purport. Lord Krishna continued to give his verdict to Arjuna. Do not think that the great generals like Duryodhana, Karna, and other contemporaries will think that you have left the battlefield out of compassion for your brothers and grandfather. They will think that you have left out of fear for your life. And thus their high estimation of your personality will go to hell. So such losses for a Kshatriya is worse than death. That's even if Arjuna says, out of compassion, I think this and that, they'll just say, you're just afraid. You see all of us here, and you're afraid. All 11 Akshahinis of us, you only have 9 Akshahinis. We have Bhishma, Drona, Kripa, you know, Karna. You're afraid, that's all. You've been speaking all these years, now we understand. You're just a coward. 36. Your enemies will describe you in many unkind words and scorn your ability. What could be more painful for you? And then the final verdict in this verse. O son of Kunti, either you will be killed on the battlefield and attain the heavenly planets, or you will conquer and enjoy the earthly kingdom. Therefore, get up with determination and fight. So, Krishna has pointed out here that, you know, we're not going to enjoy ourselves. You know, because he's making his point that Arjuna said we're not going to enjoy ourselves. So, Krishna is just arguing that point. You'll either go to the heavenly planets you'll enjoy, or you'll be sovereignty over the whole earth and you'll enjoy it. What do you mean you won't enjoy it? So this is all why this argument is going on up to this point. Is because Arjuna was saying his fighting depends upon his enjoyment or not. You know, his emotional and physical rewards that he will get from the fighting. So Krishna has used this tactic here. But now we see in this next, then he starts going to the platform of, he starts taking this up now. 38. Do thou fight for the sake of fighting, without considering happiness or distress, loss or gain, victory or defeat, and so doing you will never incur sin. So if you do, if you follow in the proper consciousness, then there's no sin. Okay, then there's a whole explanation here. I think the Baladev points out, and Gurijan is giving at this point. Previously in verses 11 through 30, to remove Arjuna's arguments against fighting, Krishna presented jnana, the difference between the body and the soul. Because Arjuna and the other warriors are eternal souls, no one would die. Only the body, which unavoidably perishes, can be slain. After presenting these arguments, Krishna encouraged Arjuna to fight based on fruit of considerations, karma, to gain pleasure and to avoid suffering. Now Krishna instructs Arjuna to combine both jnana, knowledge, and karma, activity, and fight without material attachment. Working in this detached consciousness is called nishkam karma, or buddhi yoga. Detached work on the platform of knowledge. Srila Baladeva Vidyabhushan defines buddhi yoga as nishkam karma yoga, incorporating jnana within the self. In other words, you have the understanding on why you're doing things, and you perform your activities without the desire for results. Not that you necessarily sit down and are seen studying books all day. This is nishkam karma. This jnana like that. It means that you, with knowledge you work. And that gives you, that becomes. So this is Baladeva Vidyabhushan, then he very much presents this, and this is supported by Srila Prabhupada, that this is devotional service. Okay, so then one can perform nishkam karma yoga on one of two levels, depending upon the advancement of one's transcendental knowledge. One who simply has jnana, knowledge that he is not the body, performs nishkam karma, detached work. Such a person receives no reactions for his work because his knowledge has fostered his detachment from the work's results. However, one who has actual knowledge of Krishna possesses superior knowledge. He not only knows of his spiritual identity beyond this body, but also knows that he is Krishna's eternal servant. Such a person who performs nishkam karma, but he receives no reactions for his work because he offers the fruits of his work to Krishna. Both nishkam karma yogis are free from reaction because they practice detachment and knowledge. But the nishkam karma yogi, who aspires for Krishna's loving service, is far superior. He may not yet be on the level of transcendental devotional service, but his activities will one day lead him to Krishna's lotus feet. The nishkam karma yogi, who knows only that he is not his body, may, if he desires, Brahmavad liberation, gradually attain mukti. Or if his transcendental knowledge increases because he associates with Vaishnavas, he may elevate his desire to attain Krishna's service. Krishna's purport brings this verse to the level of bhakti. Lord Krishna now directly says that Arjuna should fight for the sake of fighting because he desires the battle, meaning Krishna desires this battle. There is no consideration of happiness or distress, profit or gain, victory or defeat in the activities of Krishna consciousness. That everything should be performed for the sake of Krishna is transcendental consciousness. So there is no reaction to material activities. So in other words, we do, means here we say, he says fight for the sake of fighting because Krishna wants it. So this is not duty for the sake of duty, like the not as well informed nishkam karma yogi, that he may work just because it's supposed to be his duty, but he doesn't get sin, but he doesn't necessarily get Krishna. Right? Like that. He just works because he thinks this is the way one should be, and he frees himself from material nature, so he may get liberation. But it doesn't mean that he will get Krishna. So this means that you're he's fighting for the sake of fighting because Krishna wants it. So this is this makes the platform, even in Nishkam Karma, two points are there. That you see, Krishna says, okay, in knowledge you work without attachment to the result. And you see many Indians, they'll also profess this. You go to life members all over. I've seen many, many, many people talk about it. It's just duty for duty's sake. Don't worry about the results. But they also don't worry about Krishna. So the devotee knows that if we perform these activities that are prescribed by the acharyas, then that's because that pleases Krishna. If we do them without desire for result, there's no sin, and we go back to Krishna. It's devotional service. So Prabhupada points that out. So the one is not devotional service, the other is. Yeah, okay. Actually, Krishna in this verse has directly instructed Arjuna to fight. Through his order, in the form of requesting Arjuna to fight dutifully for the sake of fighting. Actually, Arjuna's fighting will ultimately be impelled by his desire to fulfill the order of Krishna's. This is bhakti. Krishna wants Arjuna to fight on his order, as his surrendered servant, with bhakti. Detachment, detached from the results. In this way, Arjuna will remain sinless. So there's no sin. Arjuna is very worried about sin. So now, if one does so on Krishna's order, then there's no sin. So this aspect, happiness, distress, profit or gain, victory, defeat, this is how we work. Lord Chaitanya wants his preaching mission. You know, we have been given by the acharyas, and we work. If there's profit or loss, happiness or not, that we're not worried. We just know that this is what the acharyas have told us to do. This is what we want to go for. So we have to be very, very careful that this is our motive. Otherwise, we step down from nishkam karma into sakam karma. Sakam means you're doing it because you want the result. Though, of course, because being pious and knowing about Krishna, you're going to give some of the result to Krishna. But that's very different than this nishkam karma. So this nishkam karma is very dynamic and very progressive. In one lifetime, you can go back to Godhead, engaging your conditioned nature in Krishna's service. But sakam is very dangerous, more dangerous. Of course, once one's taken to devotional service, one will progress, one will go back to Godhead. I think Srila Prabhupada was mentioning about some devotees. Somebody was saying that, you know, this devotee went, that devotee went, and all that. And then Prabhupada says, yes, they've gone, but their name is written in the book to go back to Godhead. Krishna's already put their name there. It's just they temporarily stopped for this time. Then in the future, Krishna will trick them again, catch them and again engage them. But if one is working on this platform, Nishkam Karma Yoga, for Krishna, then very quickly one can be purified and go back to God. Okay, so this is very much preferred here. What to do. Now we're to the stage of the bhakti. This is, so, should we stop here? Continue tomorrow? The time is up. There's just so many nice comments. Is the original outline very, very short. But in here, he's making so many comments by the acharyas and Baba's comments. Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Srila Prabhupada ki, Samaveta Bhaktabrinda ki, Jai Hare Gaura.